You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Ishtar, a bearded goddess of sex and war from ancient Mesopotamia. She was hot-tempered with a lust for conquest, and her priestesses were transgender.
Oya, Yoruba goddess of the wind, storms, lightning, tornadoes, thunder, commerce, and war. She rules the destruction that comes before positive change.
Atalanta, fleet-footed huntress and heroine of ancient Greece who joined the Argonauts. She helped slay the Caledonian boar and refused to marry any man who couldn't beat her in a foot race. She also became a PDA lion.
Eats Papalotl, a skeletal warrior goddess of the Aztec pantheon, sometimes depicted with butterfly wings lined with obsidian knives.
This episode is part of our Women of Myth series, where we interview podcasters, authors, scholars, and more about the amazing women of world mythology.
It's based on our book of the same name, Women of Myth, illustrated by the amazing Sarah Richard. It's available wherever books are sold, or go to ancienthistoryfangirl.com to find links to a bookstore near you.
Love a monster.
I'm Jenny Williamson.
And I'm Jen McMenemy.
And this is Ancient History Fangirl. We are so thrilled to welcome Jasmine Elmer to the podcast. Hi, Jasmine.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Good. Jasmine has worked for over 20 years in the field of classical education. She combines her experience in the field with educational charity work and developing new and creative ways to represent the ancient world in the public sphere, including as a TV presenter and in her podcast, Legit Classics. Welcome, Jasmine.
We're so excited to have you here.
Yeah, this is so fun. Can't wait to get started, guys.
So can you tell us where your passion for the classical world came from?
Yeah, it's a really good question because I never really can pinpoint the exact moment. There are like little moments that kind of happened in my childhood and then when I grew up. And little glimmers of interest. So I came from like a really poor background, so we didn't really go away very often or do many things. But when I was 15, I got to go to Pompeii, and I was like, what is this place? And it was just so amazing. Like, I just felt that if you've been there, if you've had the luxury of going to any of these sites, you just can feel the like energy of the place. Well, if you're into it, right? Not some people whiz around and go for the ice cream. If you're like into it, you're a proper geek on it. But I just stood there and I was like, oh my God, I'm touching something that's 2,000 years old. And you know how captivating the story is of what happened at Pompeii. So that kind of got me into it. And I think like muddled in with my mum telling me Greek myth stories when I was younger. And I kind of like, oh, these stories are cool. But we didn't get it at school. So it was kind of just through some like, I guess, personal experiences like that, that I started to get interested in it. And then it just won't go away. Like a bad rash carries on.
That is one way to describe our interest in the ancient world, I suppose.
Well, I think you know that I like to joke about, so that's why I've said that. But yeah, no, I've never tried to get rid of it, by the way. I've never gone to the doctor and asked for a special ointment to get rid of my love of the ancient world. But it's
no,
more just,
why would we do that?
Yeah, no, why would you? And it just was there in that moment, and then it just never went away. And if anything, it's got, I'm now 40, I turned 40 at Christmas, and it's like now it's even bigger, I think. it's like it's growing every decade that goes on. It just gets like bigger and bigger. So I'm making it sound like a medical condition now, so I'll stop talking.
I mean, I wouldn't disagree with it being a medical condition. Like, I feel like I had a very similar trajectory here.
You didn't come from the kind of background where you had it around you all the time. So you had to find it for yourself. And that's kind of what happened with me. And so in my work, what I really want to do is just make that easier for people. Because, you know, asking people in a modern world to go searching for something like this is really quite a big ask with everything that's bloody going on. So I think the more we can just go, hey, you don't need to do that much work to get to this point where you're into it. You know, there's so many ways to get into it that just go for it, I think. So that's what I'm trying to say in a really long-winded way is the way I got into it still impacts me today. I still think about that a lot today, of that experience. And when I'm talking to people that don't know anything about it, don't know where to start, I think of that moment and think, well, what did that mean to me? And I can tap into that emotion to help me connect with other people. So, and I know you guys do the same thing. So,
absolutely. Yeah. Neither one of us, Jen and I, have talked about this on the podcast many times. Neither one of us has a background in classics or history. We're both English majors, both have bachelor's degrees. We just really love it. I grew up in the States where, like, in my area at least, there just isn't a lot of ancient stuff. Like, I can't just walk out my door and find ancient ruins, you know, from thousands of years ago. I mean, there are places in the US where you can find that, but not where I was.
Is that thing in Nashville where you've got like the fake Parthenon or something? Isn't there like, yeah.
There are some Native American ruins that are quite old. That's not as easy to find or ubiquitous necessarily. Where I grew up in Vermont, there are a few stone ruins that might be ancient and that also might be colonial era root cellars or something. It's kind of a local mystery, but where I grew up, it is hard to find that stuff.
I think that's that thing where we're so spoiled in Europe. We forget that we're so surrounded by this history in the UK, in mainland Europe. You forget. I'm actually trying to make the point that we're quite spoiled in Europe, is what I mean. It's kind of like we forget.
From my perspective, a bit you are, yeah. But like, you know, I'm sure I was spoiled in other ways.
So I've said this a few times. My grandfather was from Italy, and he was very much always trying to get me into the classical world. And when I was little, he tried teaching me Italian. And I think his proudest moment of me was when I told him I was going to take Latin in school, because my school, I went to just a normal American public school, and they happened to offer Latin as one of the choices. It was a really difficult language because nobody else speaks it. But my grandfather was so thrilled. I remember sitting there looking at these sort of like textbooks that would show me what the ancient Roman house looked like or the ancient Roman street, and just thinking, I'm never going to go to Italy because my family didn't have much money. I'm the oldest of three and we didn't travel like that. You know, if we were going to have a family holiday, it would be to see other members of our family, maybe a few states over. So I never thought I would ever visit any of the places I was studying. I felt quite disconnected from it for a long time. And then weirdly, I married a British guy and did go to Pompeii and had the same feeling you had.
Nice. I get it. It must be interesting for you as well, because it's part of your heritage. It's part of your personal heritage. So I don't have that in my family. And I'm talking about the classical world here right for a moment, because, you know, I've got other heritage that's different. But I wonder how that is for you, right? Because you sort of know that somewhere down the line, probably Roman, possibly Greek. I love how Italians, when you go to Italy, the kind of way that Roman culture is so integrated into their modern life. I mean, first of all, so much of the way of life you can find the connection to from ancient Rome to modern Italian living. And what do I mean by that? Just kind of like the acknowledgement of ancestry and how important it is, and history, and kind of certain elements of the way of the Mediterranean way of life are very Roman. I'm not here saying that the Italians are going across Europe and making provinces out of everything. That's not what I'm saying.
I hope not.
No, they left that behind a while ago.
But yeah, when I go there, like, I kind of think, I find that as a British person, because obviously we've got Roman stuff around us, modern Britain and Roman ruins, that's not the same. There's a disconnect. But when I go to Italy, I'm like, hey, you guys understand it. And you've even grown your cities, your communities around some of it. And they're very proud of it. And I kind of find that really beautiful. So when you go there, I think that's the other thing, because it feels like part of modern Italian living as well. So it's even brings it closer to you. So you might be listening to this thinking I'm obsessed with Italy, and you'd be right. I'm obsessed with Italy. I'm thinking about just retiring there, living in Tuscany, drinking the wine.
I mean, the food alone is a great reason, but also amazing food, amazing wine, and ruins. Like, I don't know what else I would want.
I'm so sad because lots of things have come out about my childhood, including we had a farm in like in the mountains up in a town above Naples, sort of not far from Pompeii. For like many generations, that was there for so long and eventually had to be sold, I think, in the 80s. Because nobody would go back and pay the taxes because you had to go back every year to pay the taxes. And I'm like, if you just waited 20 years.
Oh, my God. That's so annoying. Because I was about to suggest that we go and start our own, I don't know, classical school over there where we could just do our own thing, like a weird commune.
I mean, it would have been the perfect commune place. It was just up high in the hills. So many acres, lots of drunk chickens. That's another story.
Drunk chickens?
Well, that's been a fun podcast. I'm going now. Let's leave it there. I'm off to plan my time in Italy.
I think the other thing I just wanted to add is my grandfather was so proud of his heritage and so proud of everything stemming from the classical world. When he came to America as an immigrant, like that heritage is there. It's present in the DNA of Americans, but it's also so different and removed. And I think that was one of the things that he struggled with. I wish he was still around because all the work we've done in this podcast, he would both love and hate because we're quite feminist. And, you know, we're talking about a man who would be in his 90s.
We are two women talking. I mean.
But also what I would love to do is just interrogate what he learned about classics when he was growing up and how that's changed in the past, you know, 90 years, what it looks like from someone who grew up during, you know, the era of Mussolini when things were quite different in a really rural environment.
Yeah, and the Mussolini thing's really interesting, isn't it? Because there's so much of a resurrection of Roman iconography and, you know, kind of connection with the regime. But it's interesting what you say about kind of what it might feel like to come over to the US as an immigrant, an Italian immigrant, and have that experience there. That's a really fascinating point. And not something I have. I mean, obviously, Britain has a similar thing. Like, both my parents were immigrants, for example. But I think for the States, it has obviously a slightly different story to it. So, yeah, interesting.
So, Jasmine, your profiles mentioned that your experience with classics came when you attended university. And what was it like to be introduced to these stories? And what myth or historical facts made you fall in love with the subject in a more professional sense? Made you want to dedicate your life to it, I suppose?
I mean, you're right. I began anything ancient at 18. So I had like no clue. I now see that that was a completely insane choice. I had cojones, and I think you will understand that word very, very well in America. So I was like, right, I'm just going to do this. So yes, I did it. I was like, right, let me do it. And I picked something called Ancient World Studies, and I went to University College London. So it was a really well-known school for ancient stuff in general, not just classics. So I did kind of all of it. I sort of flirted with the whole lot, is what I'm saying. So in that sense, I guess it was loads of little pockets of things. But the commonality, I think, was I ended up increasingly picking courses from the Institute of Archaeology. That links back to, I guess, that feeling in Pompeii, right? Because that was only like 3 years before at that point. And so it was all the kind of tangible things that you can get through archaeology. So I loved, less so like looking at buildings. I was never quite into the buildings, but I loved the idea of artifacts, especially like artifacts found in a domestic setting or things that like regular folk had. Or crazy stuff, like, you know, votive offerings or things that, you know, kind of had like, you know, curse tablets that were just really odd. You know, they had like a magic, like made up languages and odd things. So I loved all of that. And I ended up doing a lot more of the archaeology. I would say like 50% of my degree or maybe a bit more is archaeological based. And then the rest of it was language. I'll be honest. So I didn't want to do an ancient language. I sort of freaked out. It didn't have a good reputation when I was at school. I did French at school and my mum was like multilingual. So I have a good, very good like ability with language, but I was just like, nah, not doing that. And so when they said you had to learn an ancient language, they said you've got to do Latin or Greek. I only picked Latin because I was like, same outfit, that's going to be easier. I just did that. What I didn't know is when I started doing it, how much I'd love it. And it's because of the puzzle element, right? I loved how logical it was and this kind of puzzling, like kind of, oh, how does this fit together? And that was really new to me because I was used to kind of asking for, oh, je voudrais un couleur de tomate or something in it for, you know, instead. And I was like, this is something that I kind of like to get into. So although I said the archaeology, it was quite nice having these new experiences too and having a mixture of all of them. And I think that's affected my work today because rarely do I stick in one discipline. I'm all over the place with my disciplines. So every time I write something, talk about something, whatever it is, I always weave together those disciplines to give a full picture. That's what we do. I know everyone who does ancient stuff. You don't just go, I'm only going to look at this. Even if your interest is only in literary sources, you're still going to provide contextual information through the other sources anyway. So, but I kind of love anything where you really have to pull all the resources together to get a big picture. So in terms of stories, so although I have spent a lot of time in mythology later on, I would say that that's happened to me later in my life, where I've come to mythology as a specific area. You know, I did the obligatory Nature of Greek Myths read, G.S. Kirk, which is like, you know, standard reading. That was the first time I came across the idea that myths meant something. I was like, oh my God, they're not just stories, they mean something. And then it wasn't until obviously in teaching you talk about this a lot more, but until my own personal interest in it was resurrected when I did my master's degree, which was in 2017. So that's when I went, mythology and me are best friends. I need to carry on with this. So I picked it up then. So actually, I'm somebody, an example of somebody that really came to that passion later in life. So I'm a big advocate for, like, if you like it, you can pick it up anytime. You don't need to be going back and having all this experience of it. Just pick it up, run with it, love it. You can study it as and when you want. And that's my mythology kind of connection, really.
I absolutely love what you said about how you came to it in bits and pieces, because I do think connection comes from a variety of places. And one of the things that our podcast has taught me, and we started our podcast about 5 years ago now, is that understanding the larger world doesn't just come from understanding the stories or the curse tablets or the artifacts. It comes from all the different places that sort of whisper to you and build this picture. So yeah, connection to me is what drags you in. I think that's a great way of teaching and learning about the ancient world.
Yeah, I mean, that underpins everything. I totally agree with you. But the other thing that I wanted to say is, I don't know how old you ladies are. I mean, I can see these guys on Zoom, on the videos. They look very young and fresh. But the reason I make that point about age is also because your interests are always changing, right? Your experience is always changing. So I've been doing classics now for 22 years. So the very first things I was interested in are completely different to what I'm interested in now. So for example, when I became a parent, I got a lot more interested in, I mean, I had a difficult time when my son was born. So for me, I was like, oh my God, motherhood has become a bit more interesting to me. What did ancient, how did they cope with this stuff? Because I know that we don't hear about that very much, but it just made me think about it in a different way, even if I couldn't exactly answer that inquiry. And I love that. Like, I don't have to be married to the same thing. I think that a professor might, I mean, professors obviously change their all the time what they're looking at. But I think, you know, if you go down the academia route, you sort of slightly marry yourself into certain different, this is the route I'm going. So if you write a PhD and it's literary, it's not that you can't go across to archaeology. It's just it becomes more and more difficult, right? But someone like me, a free agent, I don't feel like I need to do that. I'm not trying to prove myself in an academic career. And there are certain like no-go areas for me that I just have never been able to find interesting. Example being Roman economy. That's not going to ever happen for me. No disrespect to anyone doing it, because thank God some people are interested in Roman economy. But there's no chance. It's also because I'm not interested in the economy in general. It's all right to not like bits of it. You don't have to love it all. And no disrespect to colleagues working in those fields. But I'm like, that's your gig. You enjoy it. And they might not like my stuff. That's cool. So I think chopping and changing as well, and just, it doesn't really matter. You don't have to wedge yourself to a particular type or genre or thing. You can adapt to it. I love that.
We experienced this too when we, last season, we really left the Greco-Roman world because we felt a little bit burnt out. So what we did was we went to somewhere else in the ancient world and talked about ancient mysteries. And I think it's something we're only able to do because we are just like you, Jasmine. We're free agents. Like, we are not writing dissertations, we're not advancing the scholarship in the same way that someone in academia is. So we're able to go to different places and find that passion and that connection somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm saying that as a privilege. I see that as a privilege. I understand. This is not a damnation against those, like you say, working really hard in the field to acknowledge.
No, they're doing the work that allows us to do other things.
They're doing the actual work that we are not doing.
I guess it depends on how you guys, I don't know if you use labels on yourself, but like, I haven't really found the word yet for exactly what I am. I mean, I think the closest thing I've come to is like public historian. but only because that label exists already. It doesn't still quite fit, because I'm also mega creative. Like, I'm about to launch my own classics brand, which we can talk about in a bit, but it's like a mashup of education, advocating for things, but being really creative. And like, you know, you guys out in your pod as well, like, it's a really creative industry, and writing, you know, really creative. So I don't really know what I am. I don't know what to call it, you know, the thing that we are. And I think it's because it's quite new, the thing that we're doing, all of, you know, as a collective group of individuals that are working in these areas, it's quite a new thing.
You've been an educator for 20 years in lots of different schools, right? And I know accessibility is a big passion of yours. What do you think needs to be done in the education world, or perhaps more broadly, to make the classics accessible to more people?
This is actually a super complex answer. And so I'm going to try and just give broad strokes, because it's very detailed. And the reason I kind of preface with that is because it matters what context you're in. We can't just have like a slapdash approach and this is what we're going to do, everyone, because this is going to be a massive, massive shock to people. All people are different. We can't just go, right, let's just make everyone do Latin at school because that'll be fine. That just doesn't make any sense. So this is why it's very complex, because in the educational setting, if we begin there, because let's be real, that's where a lot of people, if they have the opportunity, start their relationship with any subject. Let's not worry about classics for a moment, but that's where you learn to like something, right? Like my son, he's 6. Annoyingly, he's hardcore down the science route at the moment. And how does he know he loves that? I mean, because his dad is science, so maybe that's what it is. But it's also because, you know, he's experiencing these subjects in school and he's learning that he enjoys that kind of thinking. So that's one of the things. We need to get kids actually having a chance with it. In the UK, that is part of the primary school curriculum, elementary school curriculum. But it's a bit kind of wishy-washy. Not every school has to do it. It's not for very long. It's not embedded. So that's the first thing. We need to give as many kids as much chance to experience it. And I don't mean just chuck it on for some. We have this thing like where they might put it on for enrichment, like, oh, let's get some smart kids to look at the Romans. Absolutely not. That's not what I'm about. So that's the first thing. And I think as you then, that evolves out of, you know, the school setting, or, you know, throughout school, we need to be changing our approach then to how we do it. So again, depending on the demographic or the individual that's learning it, the approach needs to change. So that's quite difficult for schools, right? Because obviously they're beholden to qualifications. So the people that make the qualifications have a lot of power. So they need to kind of be in on this gig as well. But I think if you're just a teacher and you're thinking, how can I adapt this material? You're someone in the educational context, what can I do? That is where making it relevant is the most important thing you can do. In all my years of teaching, and I'm very proud to say that I was very focused on making sure my students enjoyed it, number one. And it's like, how are they going to enjoy it? Because let's be real, what you enjoyed at school, you carried on with. So what it's about is about, like, how are you going to engage young people? Young people increasingly in the modern world as well need you to show them the why. So everything has to be led with the why. You can't start a lesson and go, hey, I'm going to talk about Julius Caesar. Who cares? Like, especially if you don't know who the guy is, right? I don't care. I don't really fancy chatting about that guy. Who is he?
Oh, he's going to be so mad to hear you say that. He's listening right now.
Let's be real. None of the ancients would have liked me because I'm too much. I'm a woman and I speak really loudly and I don't let people talk crap. So they're going
to
hate me.
We're all women talking. They wouldn't listen to this podcast anyhow.
You know what? I would say you have a shot with Julius Caesar because he did like powerful women.
He wanted to, like, you know, be with powerful women.
And use his connections to powerful women to advantage. Let's be clear.
Absolutely. He was an absolute slippery snake. But, you know, he'd let you talk.
Unless we uncover some kind of evidence that Julius Caesar looked exactly like Henry Cavill, I'm probably not interested.
Spoiler, he did not look like Henry Cavill.
I just think we need to also be encouraging just adults. So, like, I have met so many people in my life. I'm sure you will have as well, where the story is, I kind of love all this stuff, but I didn't know where to start. I don't know how to find the stuff. I don't know any. Also this kind of, like, there's a fear that I think comes with this concept that classics is an elitist subject. And so if I need to be so clever to do it, and now I'm doubting myself. And that's especially true of languages, of course. And so I think adults come with like a bit of an emotional baggage attached to it. And when I've met these adults and they're like, I mean, I'm not going to name this person because it's not fair, but I think of somebody that I know really, really well, who is just a regular adult doing their life, no connection to classics, really wants to learn, but just doesn't know how to do it. And this sort of has a bit of a fear. And I think that's where us talking about that and acknowledging that, because that is something our subject has created. We haven't created it, but it is a reality. So I think we have to be real about that, and we have to expose that a little bit for people and go, we know that's there. And also, you know, that thread of the why continues there as well, doesn't it? That's another reason why a lot of the stuff I do has a bit of humour in, because it's just, that's how I am anyway. So I can't really turn it off, to be honest. But also, I just think that helps break down the barrier of elitism, because when you have, let's be honest, you've sat in front of these individuals. I'm, again, no naming anyone. But when you summon up an image of a classicist in your head, you've probably got a certain image that you're thinking of. And so that, you know, if we think that, and I happen to know, I know a lot of classicists in this country, especially, and they're very diverse, but actually in reality, there is this dominating, you know, type of individual. So if we think that, can you imagine what it's like from the outside? So these are all the things I want to do. So it's kind of like how teaching it more, how we're teaching it, leading with the why, and, you know, kind of when we're talking to people, really acknowledge like openly the problems with our subject and do our best to change it, which is what you're doing with your work and what I'm doing with my work.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Hello everyone, it's Takuya here.
And I'm Gabby.
And we are the hosts of History of Everything, a podcast which you can probably guess by the name is, well, I mean, it's about everything. Do you want to know why people thought potatoes were evil and would give you syphilis? Are you curious about all the stories of the terrible and stupid ways that people have kicked the bucket over the years? Do you want to hear tales about all of the different badasses of history and the lives that they had brought to life? Well, if so, then look no further. History of Everything is just the right podcast for you. It's available on Spotify, Pandora, and anywhere else that you get your podcast from. Join us for some fun and just see how weird and wacky history can be.
I really connect to that because I think that there absolutely is somebody you think of when you think of who a classicist is. That's probably a white man who comes from a wealthy background. And if you are non-white, if you're a woman, if you're queer, if you come from a working class background, it's not only that you are presenting a different picture of what a classicist can look like, but you're also coming at it from a different mindset where you are interested in different things. So you're going to go after different stories. So we don't just get the stories of rich white men in the classics. We get other stories because there are those other stories out there.
And I also want to add, because I always add this, if you're coming at it from a neurodiverse background where you are dyslexic like I am, or you're ADHD, a lot of times you see these as subjects where they require an intense amount of hyperfocus that is sometimes daunting. I found most people in the history community online to be incredibly accepting, but I did come into this field feeling like, I am a fraud. I can't remember most of the Latin I knew. And I really struggle with reading and my focus. How am I going to do this? We've done it anyway somehow, and I think that's why I keep putting it out on the podcast, because I don't hear a lot of people talking about it, and I think that visibility, if you're neurodiverse, is super important.
Yeah, I totally understand. And we're doing that all in our own different ways, right? Because I have like three of those tick boxes. I'm working class, I'm mixed race, and I'm female. So let's just tick the boxes. And I'm really happy. I'm very open book. I'm happy to talk about how that's affected me. That's fine. And it is interesting, because the more I'm doing that, the more people embrace that. And I'm really happy. I'm doing it for exactly the same reasons. I'm like, you don't expect someone like me to be doing what I'm doing, especially when you're working in audio. People can't always see you. They don't know you. Like some of your listeners today, they're not going to know who I am. They might not have heard of my work. So, and they can't see me necessarily. So it's like, you know, they can hear that and they can see, right, okay. And what's hard about it, and I don't know how you guys have experienced this, but the more I do that, certain communities embrace it, but I have started to get more abuse about it. And I, to be honest, I could not care less. They can come at me. I'm from East London. There's nothing you people have got that's going to bother me, right? But do you know what? It makes me worry, because I think that just goes to show how hard it is for people to be different in this particular. I mean, it's hard for everyone trying to be different in anything that is kind of homogenous, right? But it's really interesting to me, because the more I do it, the more I notice that coming up. And like, oh, why are you constantly talking about being mixed race? I'm like, because how do people need to know that I'm doing that and I'm representing my community? Because how many Pakistani classicists do you people know? You know, it's not really, certainly not in the, they probably are more in academia, but certainly not in a public facing job, you know. So it's not as easy as what I'm trying to say. So I'm sure you both recognize that in your own work and everything. But I'm just going to say, I'm not going to stop doing it. And I'm very genuine, and I'm not going to stop doing it, because people need to see that it's okay. If I'm one of those people that can make that happen for someone, then I'm happy to take any blows. I'm not really bothered. And it's a little bit of a worry. The more the profile gets, you know, bigger, and the more work I'm doing, you're like, oh, I can talk a big game, but what is it really like to get so much of that? And it's where the internet can be a bit of a tough place, right, to be. So I think this is nice for me to talk about, because I haven't had the opportunity to explain that yet, probably in many podcasts, because I do a lot of podcasts where I'm talking about a topic, right, rather than me. But I think if you are listening to this, I think it's really important that you try and understand why people are making those comments, why we are sharing elements of our personal backgrounds. It's not because I expect you to go, oh, diddums. It's because I want you to see that people like me can do it. I don't need your like pat on the back. It's all good. Thank you for giving it, but I don't need it. I'm here to represent my communities. And I'm really glad that you guys are doing it for your communities, and anyone working in the classical field that is bucking the trend. The more you speak up about who you are and have the confidence to do that, the more you're going to make the change that we need to desperately make in this subject.
Jen and I just wrote a book, Women of Myth, and we were chatting with you online in some capacity, and you had mentioned that you also were writing a book about women in world mythology, and we were super interested to hear about what your book was about and how you were going to tackle it, because we're really interested in this subject. So would you like to tell us about that project and how you're approaching it and your vision for your book?
Absolutely. So it's in its infancy, so that's my little immediate caveat, because obviously some things I haven't got a clue about. If you're sitting there thinking that all authors know what they're writing about, that's a bit of a fallacy. I have a direction. Okay, so what I wanted to do, I'll begin with like the general and move into the topic, but I really wanted to do something that was cross-cultural. So because my interests are really diverse, as I hope I've explained, I was like, I really want to look at a theme across different cultures. I'm big into feminist takes on things, but obviously, and I know you guys will agree, but like, you know, making sure it's not overtly feminist, so you come away from the realities of what you're looking at. So I wanted to have a feminist take on something. And then I read some really interesting articles about a few different goddesses. And I thought, okay, goddesses feel like a really interesting space for me to explore these concepts. So I wanted it to be diverse, because part of it is it's going to be, the general theme will be an examination of feminine qualities in goddesses with a view to kind of subverting all of that. Because when you look at ancient cultures, and I'm generalizing here, and this is where I promise the book will be better than this, but
it's already pretty good. I mean,
I know exactly. I'm like, where can I pre-order?
I need to write it first. So I wanted to spotlight different cultures, and hopefully cultures that some of us recognize and are more familiar with, but also ones that we aren't familiar with. I mean, specifically here in the West. So you're going to kind of get a whistle-stop tour. And the idea is that we look at goddesses in each of their individual cultural contexts. That's really important to point out. So there'll be different chapters on different goddesses from different cultures with the context provided. And it's kind of an exploration of their mythology, but also that, you know, kind of like I said, the historical context, the archaeological context too, to kind of get us to look at that goddess through the eyes of the people of the times. So that's really important. And to really just go, whole feminine, masculine dichotomy thing that's been going on. Is that really a thing? And it's like, when you look at it in this way, and, you know, what's so fascinating about the research so far is there's so many interesting goddesses where those edges between what we perceive as masculine and feminine are very blurred. This is basically like any gender can read this book. This is about qualities and about smashing down those very, very firm boundaries that we have inherited today through the context of the goddess. So what I found is people have worked in this space, and there are lots of really fantastic books that work on a goddess or a certain small group of goddesses, but it's pretty bold to go across a number of goddesses from different cultures, and there are books that exist that do that, but perhaps they're not as up to date. So it's a very new take on these things. I only do big bold things, so I'm obviously slightly terrified about it, but I'm loving it because it's also tapping into my interest in different cultures, and it's a real academic challenge that I'm really enjoying. So watch this space. I can't say much more about it at the moment in terms of what it's called, because I have a working title for it, which I think it will be, but I can't really say what that is at the moment. And I can't tell you when it'll be out or the publisher or anything at the moment. So I'll just give me a bit of time, and then I can update people later.
Is there a feminine figure, a goddess, that you have discovered throughout your research so far that you didn't know about before and that you're really excited about telling the world about?
Yeah, for sure. Like the goddess Inanna or Ishtar, which I know she's in your book as well. For me, I focus on Inanna because what I didn't want to do, again, there is, as you will know from your own book and research, there is such a kind of confusion about these goddesses and their individual cults, and kind of where does one start and one end, the conflation of the two. And that was quite murky. And obviously, this is because it won't shock anyone, this is an accessible book for the general public. So it's not that I won't acknowledge that. I didn't want to get into that. So I thought easier to look at the Sumerian context only. So looking at her has been really, really, really fascinating. And I had a kind of surface level understanding of Sumerian culture before I went into it. But it was quite new to me. I mean, as a figure, she fascinates me because, you know, here we are looking at the very earliest known civilizations. And, you know, the whole concept of gender is so much more blurred than we think it is. And it's a very surprising exploration of a very, very ancient culture. And it did things that I didn't quite fully expect it would do. And you'll have to read the book to know what I mean. But what I really love about her is just, you know, what she symbolises and all of the different qualities that she, you know, kind of has are so interesting to us in terms of breaking down this kind of gender terms of feminine and masculine. The particular fact that I love is that she had these priests that were part of her worship called the Gala. They are gender neutral in that respect, in many respects, feminine, masculine, different genders. So I kind of loved that it's not just something that you can, you know, analyze. It's actually physically happening in the ritual around her worship as well. So the Gala are really, really fascinating. So I just love that. And then next minute I'll be onto another culture. You know, then that'll be that chapter done and I'll be onto another culture. So I love all this work that's going on in this space at the moment. There's quite a lot of people that are writing in this way, and I really love it. I think it's really powerful.
I completely agree, and I also find this fascinating. We covered Ishtar, who is, like, I guess the Akkadian version of this. They really did combine Sumerian and Akkadian traditions with the Enheduanna hymns, and a lot of that was really, like, gender nonconforming as well. So we really went with that with our portrayal of Ishtar, which is not how we usually see her portrayed, right?
Exactly. And that, I mean, that's where there's a bit of complexity, isn't there, in terms of the evidence and how you're going to look at the evidence because of the dating of all of this. But whatever way you look at it, depending if you're going to allow the conflation, what you're going to do. And I think that would just surprise people. We're talking about ancient Iraq in terms of location. What dominates our mind is the strong feeling of classical patriarchy, especially in the West. When we think ancient, we think of that. I'm not saying that that didn't exist. I am. But I'm trying to look at the boundaries, the peripheries, the edges, the things that show you that actually it's not quite as rigid as that. Because, you know, people kick against patriarchy, shock horror. How do they do that? You know, and often in the worship of goddess, we get that. We get people, you know, owning that space and allowing, you know, kind of letting, I'm trying to say, it feels like letting the belt out after a big meal or whatever, but allowing yourself some space to expand into your own identity. And that's why the goddesses thing is because it's a sacred space. So there's a protection element right there when you're dealing with sacred spaces. So I'm excited for the ones to come. I've got quite a few that are going to be completely brand new cultures to me. I know very little about. So that's going to be really, really cool because I'm going to be in the library forever.
Sounds like an ideal Saturday night.
I know, I know. I know I'm talking to the right people when we talk about being in a library. It's like, oh, get to be in a library.
I do think that the worship, like the sacred worship of goddesses and even some gods, Dionysus is the one who pops to mind because he's always in my mind. It does show a lot of subversion of, you know, the patriarchy, because there were certain elements that goddesses had in particular. I mean, Artemis, we did a whole episode on her. It was such a fascinating ball of contradictions. Dionysus is a ball of contradictions. Aphrodite, I'm just thinking Greco-Roman at the moment. But outside of that, there are many like Ater goddess and so many goddesses who come from rigid patriarchal cultures and did other things. Huitica is another fascinating one as well. She's super fascinating. So yeah, I think looking into the worship of goddesses does tell you a lot about the culture and how they functioned, how rigid the patriarchy was, and where the sort of release valve was for the patriarchy sometimes.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's interesting that you say that, because obviously I'm at the beginning of my feelings about this. But in some ways so far, I don't think I would say it's a reflection of societal views of patriarchy. I would say it's a safer space for people to kind of subvert that. So what I found so far is that like Sumerian culture is a patriarchal culture still, but within the worship of goddesses, I mean, it's not just here. There are some really cool things about potentially how Sumerian women lived, regular Sumerian women. But I'm less about, I don't know if this is what you were saying, so do you just say if I've got this wrong from what you were saying, but I'm less about looking at the goddess. It's a kind of mirror, what you're describing, I think, is a mirror theory where you're kind of looking at how goddesses relate to what's going on in culture. And that's a valid way to look at it, but I'm sort of doing the opposite in some ways. I'm sort of suggesting that these are sacred spaces, but importantly, regular people are part of those sacred spaces, and those people are also part of culture, right, of society. But it might be that they might be more normative out in that society, behaving as they should in nice patriarchy. But when you enter the sacred space of the goddess, that you're able to be something else, and that's where they're playing with identity. So that's kind of what I am hoping I find in all of these ancient cultures.
Yeah, I think that there's a real thread that we've found, because we did a whole series on our podcast about gender nonconforming people in mythology and history, specifically in the classical world. What I found, I'm sure Jen, you could corroborate this, is that frequently being gender nonconforming was a province of the gods and the goddesses. That was a quality of gods.
Yeah, but because they're non-human and they can behave in certain different, more kind of fluid ways than what we can as what has been imposed on us as human beings. So I get that. Yeah, it's like a certain space. Yeah, so that's really interesting.
Yes, but also there's the sacred place of worship where you see people being able to have power and agency that they don't normally have in their outside roles because of their devotion to their goddess. Usually it's a goddess. Again, the worship of Artemis is absolutely fascinating. We've talked about it. I can't wait to see what you do in your book about it. Aphrodite is another really good one, Inanna and Ishtar. But there are certain things, Hestia is another one, where people who may live in a strict patriarchal society get certain, I don't want to say benefits, but they get certain privileges as a result of being in service to a goddess.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I guess it's interesting because we can equate this to people's feelings today about gender. I don't know enough about States and how have you what you have in your media narrative about this, but you know, I know much more about in the UK. And for me, it's about, you know, I think that when you speak to people and they're thinking about what are the barriers for them feeling like they can have their own identity, their gender identity, and it's always around safety, creating safety, and when they feel like they're in a safe space that they can explain if they don't want to, whatever, but just be themselves. And so that's what I think you're getting a little bit in these goddess cultures. And I, you know, there's obviously, we haven't really spoken about this and we won't, because otherwise it'll go off on a massive tangent. But we obviously, there's mystery cults as well to look at. So obviously we still don't know what they are all the time, what happened in them. And, you know, that's there's a lot of power in that again, isn't there? If you're somebody that's like, okay, I don't quite fit into this mold that you're looking at. So it's just a fascinating space to look at. So I'm super pumped for it. And slightly daunted by the prospect of writing my first book, but I'm going to get it done because that's what I do. But I'm loving it, and I really hope for people when they read it. The whole point again is it's I want it to be relatable and empowering for people. So there will be some elements in it. There may be some myth retelling elements to it. I'm still working on what kind of format I want it to have. So hopefully, it will also be in that way a bit emotive and relate to people rather than just bog standard, like, you know, history book of information.
Absolutely. It sounds like such a fascinating project and really aligned with our interests as well. So I really can't wait to see what you do with it.
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore all of the weird little questions and conspiracies of the universe in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything. Everything has an explanation.
We hope.
But that is what we're here to figure out. We will dive into the science behind many popular conspiracy theories, such as vaccines causing autism, flat earth theory, and was the moon landing fake? And if so, why the heck would anyone even do that?
But it's not just conspiracies. There's a lot of cool mysteries that we will attempt to use science to explain, such as near-death experiences, what made the Vikings go berserk, and can I control my co-host with MK Ultra?
Wait, what? Anyway, make sure to check out the Mystery of Everything podcast everywhere where you find your podcasts.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
Is there a goddess that you've come across in your research for world mythology, or we could cover Greek mythology, that you really feel like you identify with the most so far?
Probably Athena.
Ooh.
Bold choice.
Do you know what it is with her? Is, I mean, like, basically, the real answer is not necessarily very many of them. And maybe that says a little bit about my own background and how I feel about my own identity. I'm like, bleh. But I think the reason I quite like Athena, I mean, there's a few things that I like about her, but the kind of qualities that she has, I guess the things that she, you know, her kind of areas of influence are really kind of hardcore things, you know, wisdom. I like that. Take a bit of that, you know, kind of the war, but the cool bit of the strategy of war, you know, the intelligence side, not just hacking people to death. We'll leave that to Ares. And I think that there's something about her that is, this again, people might disagree with this, but there is such a massive powerful force in her in these areas, but it can actually be quite underplayed or misunderstood or kind of maligned or presented as vengeful at times and just kind of like, nah, that's what she is. Her domains are really powerful domains. This is not anyone going, I'm not violent, I'm not going around wanting to start wars with people, but I think, like, you know, like having wisdom as a in a female goddess is quite a big thing. So I've always quite admired her for that in some ways, and I just get a kick-ass vibe from her. I've just always had a bit of a kick-ass vibe from her. Like, she doesn't take any rubbish, you know what I mean? There's a sort of empowerment in her that I quite enjoy. But it's quite a hard question because I just feel like I want to chop up loads of them and make a new one that would properly fit what I think I am.
I think that's fair. I feel similarly. You know, if someone asked me, it depends on the day and what I'm feeling like. I guess if Jen asked me what goddess I most identify with, depending on how cute my outfit is and how great my makeup is, I might say Aphrodite. I might say Dionysus. I don't know.
I think for me, like, as well, I think I'm going to have, if I went to world mythology rather than classical for a moment, I think I'm about to find her in this book. I think I'm going to find one that I'm like, there you go. I've got a feeling, because already Inanna's up there with, like, I'm like, yes, Inanna, I'm up for that. But I think this is the thing about saying it, because I'm mixed race as well. Like, I want to see, like, I'm going to be exploring Indian goddesses, for example, which is my, you know, my ancestry. And I think that's going to be really fascinating for me, because, like you were saying, Jen, with your Italian heritage and you feel a little bit of that in your blood, like, I haven't really explored, like, South Asian cultures before. Only again in a sort of more superficial way. So that's going to be really interesting how I feel about that one, because that's going to speak to me personally and my identity and my culture. So I wonder if that will feel more powerful to me, easier for me to make that connection.
Absolutely. And there's such rich territory there too.
Are there any monsters that are sort of coded female in world mythology or Greek mythology that are your favorite, and why? And I use the word monsters in quotation marks because I almost always come down on the side of the monster.
That's probably my main specialism, is monster myth anyway. So that's why I wrote my MA dissertation on. I do a lot of work in that space now. I can't get past the image of what I always choose. So I need to really have an intellectual thought. I really need to go and have a little chat with myself, because I always pick the chimera. I love the chimera. But the reason I still need to have a little word with myself is because the first reason I pick it, it says a lot about who I am, is I just find the goat so hilarious that I can't pick anything else.
Remind me what a chimera is. It's a goat head.
Yeah, and it's lion and snake tails. So it's kind of like this odd mashup of stuff. My MA thesis was on the chimera. So I did a lot of work on the chimera as well. It's just I should have a much more intelligent answer, but I'm always like, the goat is so funny, I need to laugh. So I was on a pod the other day talking about this, and I was just like, the goat is just so hilarious. So there are some more serious reasons why I love, because I love the symbolism of the chimera, because not to be to sort of slightly pun intended, it's multifaceted. There's lots of elements of the chimera that are really interesting. So each of those animals symbolizes something. The grouping of the animals symbolizes something. I'm big into when monsters relate to the landscape. So that's what a lot of my work was on. So the chimera has a really interesting background in the literary sources that relate her to areas of Turkey that are volcanic. So you kind of have a really interesting connection to the landscape there. So I love rationalization of myth, and monsters are a really cool way to look at that, because there's quite a rich background there, richer source material. That's what I was trying to say. But the chimera, I just think she's fascinating. And I think what's also fascinating is, like, when you look at the iconography, you get this kind of opposition, this juxtaposition of the chimera with Pegasus as a male, you know, figure. Is the chimera female? Almost certainly, yes. That is the overwhelming feeling about the gender of the chimera. But what you get is you get this kind of really interesting composition on artwork of the fight between the chimera. I know it's Bellerophon, but we're just talking over there. The chimera and Pegasus, which is, again, a bit of a sort of male-female combative thing. And I think female monsters are all fascinating for billions of reasons. But I think the one thing that I find really interesting is why they're extra scary often in ancient cultures, and usually related to the fact that they have the ability to procreate and we could have more scary monsters. I find that really, really particularly interesting. Monsters are brilliant because they mean so much more, don't they, than what you see on the surface.
Oh, yeah. We had a monster section in our book, and the monster section was really interesting. It's just like the qualities that different people would choose to assign to monsters and why those qualities were quote unquote monstrous was an interesting thought to us, especially when you're talking female monsters.
Did you have the Lamia in there? I haven't looked at it yet. Did you have the Lamia in the book?
No, we couldn't. But I was going to say the Lamia and the Imbusa are two of my favorites.
Yeah, we covered the Lamia from a Greek myth perspective and maybe a Mesopotamian myth perspective in an episode we did on ancient vampires. And she also crops up when you study Lilith, because there are some translations of the Bible that call her Lamia.
And the chimera just made me think of the Imbusa again, because she's got that leg of brass and a leg of an ass or a donkey. And you're just like, you think she's a lady, but she's a vampire, sort of.
I, It's just, I always have this image of this, like, I'm going to say it's a bloke, and he's just sitting by, a river one day, and he goes, I'm going to make up a monster, and I'm going to, it just feels like a long joke that went too far sometimes, because, you know, ultimately these are made up stories, right? So someone at some point, this tradition had to begin with someone telling this story of this individual, this monster, this whatever it is. Obviously, I get that they're inherited from different cultures sometimes, so, you know, you might have to go back further into other cultures. But at some point, someone just sat around a fire and go, I got one. Here's this crazy creature. And I just want to meet that guy. Or it could be woman, of course, but I just want to meet that person that did that and just go, do you know what's going on now? Thousands of years later, I'm writing MA thesis on this. People write books about it. People are talking about it, analysing it. It's symbolism. I think it later obviously gets its symbolism. I don't think it does in the original bit. But anyway, it's just really interesting, isn't it? Because ultimately, they are creations of the mind.
There is a common thread of women with sort of lower halves that are deer, horse, donkeys, camel. It seems to go across a lot of different cultures. So I don't know if you'll find that in your research, but like, as we were finishing the book, I was like, that's another one with a lower half that is sort of...
Ungulate. The lower half is an ungulate, is a thing.
Ungulate. Yeah, hoofed.
That's really interesting. I wonder if that's because a lot of that part of the body is concealed. So it speaks to the fear that men have of not knowing. Not knowing what's going on underneath those skirts, not knowing what that is. There's a reason it's rarely the head. I mean, I know Medusa is a very famous example where it's the head, right? But, you know, largely it's not, as you say. And I think that if you think about what they're wearing for clothing, etc., there is a mystique on that lower half. But also it will speak to genitalia as well, won't it? And procreation again and that sort of thing. So yeah, there's always a reason, right? I mean, there is even a reason for the goat. There is a reason for the goat, but I just find it funny. This is what I mean about not having to be too serious sometimes, because it is just funny, some of it. That is funny. You can laugh at that for 10 minutes.
It absolutely is. I mean, but it's such an interesting point that you bring up that I didn't even think about, is like men's fear of the difference of women. So the idea of a female monster that has a lower half being an animal or something like that is kind of, first off, it's through a male gaze, which I didn't even think about before, but it is. And it speaks to men's fear of the physical differences of women and women's bodies and their capabilities, perhaps. My mind is blown.
Yeah, well, it just makes some sense. I think that's where jumping quickly to the psychology of something and the element of phobia is really important, because that's what I mean about a reminder that everything in mythology is a creation of the human mind. What are monsters? It's an expression. It's an outward expression of our own fears. If you separate it from yourself, you can look at it from a safe distance. It's much harder to look at the monster within. It's much easier to separate it from you and look over there. That's where you get all these different examples of monsters to express various different human fears. And it's why they evolve over time. It's why nothing is static. It's why we get new literary traditions, new iconographic traditions. You get this changing, even if it's the same figure, because we are changing and our phobias are changing and society is changing. So that's why the female monsters are so interesting, because most of these are patriarchies. And so that's where it is the male fear. That's where we can say it's the male fear of stuff. I love that, because again, that's something this is one of the examples that I came to later. So this is something I came to in 2017 as part of my master's degree. And I just thought, I'm loving this. I'm loving this element of you really have to dig deep into human psychology if you're dealing with monsters. And I think you probably have to do a lot of things to do with the ancient world. But actually, psychology, as when you think about the expression and what it could mean, actually, that's a really, really clear lens with which to look at stuff. I think it makes it really much easier to understand if there is symbolism. Well, there was always symbolism, but what the symbolism is actually about. I always start there and then go from that perspective. And I find that's given me a really detailed and deep understanding of monsters in their different contexts. Love a monster. Again, talking about being relatable again, you can understand this, because our fears might be different now. They're mostly fears about our own politicians.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And our dying planet, you know.
Yes, exactly, though. If you think those are the tensions and the anxieties we have today. But there's loads of really interesting stuff and like like the wild and the kind of where the wild has moved to. So like we have to talk about like boundary of living and where the wild is now. And there's a lot on that to look at.
So do you have any other projects that you want people to know about in the works?
Yes, I do have some cool things going on. So I've launched a brand called Legit Threads, which you can go online and look at. It does international shipping. And it's loads of like classically inspired designs on clothing and like mugs and tote bags and stuff and artwork that I've all designed myself. So hopefully it's a kind of like fun way to kind of play with classics. But also it's a bit of like I'm trying to start a bit of a movement. So it's kind of like if you wear this stuff, it's like you're a bit like we mentioned about people that are being different in our community. It's like kind of your way of showing that you're part of that. And there's one collection as well where I donate 20% of the profits to the Malala Fund as well for girls, education of girls as well. So just check it out. If you like it, great, buy something. And it's legit-threads.com. Or if you just go, like you say, if you just go on my Instagram and look up Jasmine Elmer, and follow me, all the links are there. You can go and get it all from that as well. And my website's on there and everything like that. And also my podcast, Legit Classics, which you can go and see now. There's 10 episodes there and I'm going to resurrect that soon as well. So if you love the stuff, come and have a little listen.
Jasmine, where can people find you on Twitter, Instagram, the social media world?
So I'm on Instagram as Jasmine Elmer. You can find me there. And I'm also on Twitter as Jasmine Elmer. Easy peasy. And I have a website, which is jasmineelmer.co.uk, nice and easy. If you just chuck my name into Google, it'll come up. And then also there, you can find links to my website for my brand, Legit Threads, or just put Legit Threads, legit-threads.com if you need to go to it.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been amazing.
I've had a fantastic time, girls. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you all for listening. And we will see you next week.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.